Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled, Is There Hope for Humanity?
No.
Yeah, no. And, well, do we need to go on? Is there anything else we need to say at this point?
It would be a really short episode if we stomp there, though. Yeah. So I guess we'll have to hash this out or change the subject as we go.
All right, well, yeah. So I was getting ready to do the outro, but if you want to keep going. So, yeah. And actually, I guess it's about more than that, but...
Isn't it always about more than that? I mean...
Yeah. Well,
hence
no.
Why we're going to talk for the next hour, I believe.
Yes, yes. But we will figure out why the answer to the question, is there hope for humanity, is no. And we'll break it down. We'll sort it out for you, lay it out on the table for you to take a look at. And then
it's a metaphorical table, right?
Metaphorical table, and then sweep it away in a box or a garbage bin or whatever. Garbage baggie of your choosing.
Dustbin of history, where we all belong.
Yes, exactly. And, well, our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about hope for humanity, or the lack thereof, I guess.
Or the dustbin of history.
Or the dustbin of history. Mr. Jason Baldinger, who is a poet, gadfly, time traveler, musician, and all-around swell human being. And two-time now podcast guest.
I've reached an upper echelon. Is it like me and Derek Zanetti, and that's it?
You, Derek Zanetti, Adam Rousseau, formerly of the band Triggers, and Sarah Donner, and yeah, Spiff Weigand, who was the pilot episode guest.
Okay.
So, there's a couple two-timers. I think Adam and Derek are fighting it out for number one.
For the Steve Martin role.
And Adam has an art show coming up this fall. So
awesome.
So, he'll be back on soon. So, there you go. So you got some work to do, buddy.
I'm working on more books, I swear. You know,
aren't we all?
We can make this all happen. So, when your book comes out, does someone get to interview you and be you? That's my question.
You know, I say about this podcast, it's, you know, I don't offer a lot. I give people, I can say I know of one person that has bought two albums because a musician was on this show.
Okay.
Actually, Mike Miller, he's been on this show twice, Endless Mike and the Beagle Club.
All right.
Somebody bought his album, and Bill Toms, who's also been on twice. This is a big group now that we're thinking about it. Somebody bought a Bill Toms album too because he was on this podcast. So I can offer maybe a down, like somebody will pay for $7 for a Bandcamp download, maybe, or something.
There's some minor amount of exposure,
but mostly it's about the narcissistic pleasure of being interviewed. And now that I think about it, yeah, I have not had the narcissistic pleasure of being interviewed.
Well, I think you'll have to ask somebody to interview you now.
I guess so, but...
Take your spot.
Take my spot,
it'll
yeah.
be like
the
weird,
guest host
yeah,
or
it'll
something.
It'll be weird inverted world of We're All Gonna Die.
Yes, there you go.
So we're all going to live.
We're all gonna live. Yeah.
Way too long and hate everything.
Yes. Which I think you recently had a birthday, and we were talking about how maybe you've reached that point, actually, of being alive too long, and now everything is...
No. I definitely reached the point in time where I have no concept of how time happens anymore. You know, like, something blurry happened, 20 years has disappeared, and then some, and you reach this point where you're standing at 40, and it's like, okay... How did I get here? I seem to remember I was 18 last week. Maybe I was 28 last week. I don't know. It all becomes ephemeral, I suppose.
Yeah, I can only go by who was president. In terms of, like, ask how what year something happened. Like, I can figure out what year something happened, and then I can figure out how old I was. And what year is this weird matrix of who was president... What car was I driving? Because I went through a period in the aughts of having a shitty, cheap-ass car every 2 years.
Okay.
that would then not pass inspection, and then I would have to then buy another cheap-ass shitty car. Because the cheap-ass shitty car was cheaper than what it would cost to get a sticker, a legal sticker on this thing. Yeah, and so I'd do that, and then maybe what job I had, but that's it.
Yeah, there's definitely a free association at this point in time between year, job, girlfriend, car, you know.
Yeah.
Where I was living, or just like some fucked up thing that happened in that year. So it's like, oh, that year was the year that I had that nervous breakdown, or that was the year that this person died, or that was the year that, you know, planes crashed into a building, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's how it goes.
Yeah.
This is how you keep track of things, you know. It's like, oh, these two things go in tandem. You know, it's a daisy chain of ridiculous shit, tragedy, and, yeah, minutia.
Yeah, which almost sort of brings me to, I guess, maybe our real topic, if that's it, or, you know, this kind of question of the humanities and arts and its diminished place in our neoliberal world. But I previously this summer went through the project of finally, after, I think tomorrow will be 2 years that we've owned this house.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you. Finally sorting out my various libraries of different mediums.
It does look slightly more alphabetical in here than the last time.
Well, it's, you know, it's so the books are by subject. I tried to cluster authors together. So you are in the room of reference books, education books, kind of literary theory, critical theory, cultural studies, psychology is behind you. Oh, and philosophy, literary, you know, critical theory, philosophy, all that stuff. Psychology is behind you. And then graphic novels, a stack of psychology textbooks that are out of date and we don't know what to do with, and graphic novels and art history. And art history. That's what we got in this room. And all the literature is upstairs, grouped by nation and era. I mean, again, tried to cluster authors together. So at least I know that if I need, I don't know, Jean Baudrillard's Seduction, I know that it's in this room on one of two shelves.
Well, I mean, you have both the Denial of Death and the Second Sex within three shelves of each other. So, we've got something going on here.
Yeah, I got something going on, and there's some order to it. And when I did the music as well, the music is alphabetical.
Right.
Except for the cassettes, which I don't have a place for, but I have a couple hundred cassettes, and they should be. Couch.
That's where they belong.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is the last time we were supposed to talk about art and obsolete media.
Yes.
In a society that devalues it, and we ended up talking about Hope for Humanity. So you're starting with Hope for Humanity in hopes that we actually
get to obsolete media.
Okay, that's fair.
But how many people, when I said I was organizing the record collection and the music took 2 weeks, a couple days. Yeah, 4 or 5 days for each vinyl and compacted disc. The books took 6 days.
Yeah.
You know?
That sounds about right.
I no longer feel that unkempt, I need a haircut feeling all the time when I'm in my own house, which is nice.
Oh, it's good to have that relaxed moment as you're sitting around the things. And God knows, when you have too many things, you have a feeling of being oppressed by
those things. But now that they're in places, I'm not oppressed by them.
You got it.
But how many people made the joke from High Fidelity?
Are you doing this alphabetically?
Or autobiographically? And I could think about, I could probably do that, and it belies the hidden in that joke is this very real concern, issue, acknowledgement of how art and music or whatever does shape the human experience and help express part of the human experience. That's in there, mm-hmm. and that's very real, and that's why maybe people were thinking about it, or maybe thinking of me as Jack Black from that movie or something.
Ooh, that's fair.
I got the figure for it.
Over 35, we almost all have the figure at this point in time, you know?
Yeah, true. Very true. I no longer drive Deschutes, though, for my breakfast slushy and my evening slushy. When I got really bad and when my health totally kind of tanked in a almost fatal sort of way, one day, that was maybe my rock bottom. So when I went out to Sheets for breakfast and got a slushy with my schmuffins. And then after dinner, I was like, man, what am I going to do? I had nothing to do. All my friends are doing stuff. And this was back when Danelle was still in Albany. And I was like, I know, I'll drive to Monroeville Sheets and get a Pepsi slushy, a large one for
I see this moment where you're Barney Gumble. And Mo has left the bar, and you're laying there under the tap of the slushy machine.
I was,
and the dog is giving you a very disappointed look.
Yes, that's about where I was.
But the slushy dog, by the way, not your dog, not some metaphor. We're talking about the actual like Joe Cool slushy dog. I don't know his name.
Oh yeah,
you know what I'm talking about.
Puppy slushy, yes.
Puppy slushy. There you go.
There we go.
Whatever his name is.
That thing, yeah.
Yeah, that thing. I mean.
Is puppy slushy art?
No, puppy slushy is not art.
Which
it's pop art.
It's pop art, I guess, but it's also it's commercial art, and is that, you know, art has art eaten itself in a weird way? Is yes. That we have this way of visual storytelling and see how we've gone from profane to sacred now. You know, we have this empire of signs that we can see and recognize and read the world. And what has that done that has, you know, been kind of co-opted by this commercial enterprise that maybe wants to use all these tenets of humanism
right.
to sell you shit and make you feel bad about the shit you have or the shit that you didn't buy or whatever. And that's...
Well, I never feel bad about not buying the slushy. There are some records that I feel bad about not buying.
This is very true.
So I guess it depends on where your vice lies in that regard. I mean, there certainly is that disturbing moment that we recognize logos and various other forms of art in that way. Not art, but graphic design. Much quicker than we recognize plants or animals.
Yeah. That's
even the parts of a car, come to think of it.
Yeah.
We are raised on a television or now on a computer screen or a cell phone screen or whatever, so you're constantly being bombarded and barraged by advertisements of some form, hidden or otherwise. Movies are great for hiding. I mean, there's thousands of essays at this point in time about hidden product placement. So you immediately see something and associate with it as quickly as possible. But you don't always associate with what is going on around you simultaneously. It's a dangerous sort of side place.
Yeah, no, but I think, you know, I think about what you said has made me think about there is a great book by a sociologist from Britain named Jock Young called The Vertigo of Late Modernity.
Okay.
It's not in here.
I was looking for it.
I should buy it, actually. I keep thinking about it. It was a library book I borrowed from somewhere. But I speaking of consumers, I should buy that book.
I'm happy you're consuming. There is an author that will make money out of this.
This is true. He'll get $3.
Hopefully, at least.
I have a... behind you is a book one of my best friends from grad school wrote. And I was buying the book. And I texted her while I was in the bookstore. I was like, I'm buying your book. She's like, great, I just made $3. Thanks.
You've made all my time and effort so much more worthwhile.
Yes.
That $3, really. It's going to help.
It's going to help, yeah.
I can turn it into something fleeting. Yes. I can make origami out of it. A paper hat.
You know, I never asked her to... I actually... this person knows who she is. I never asked her to autograph that book. I've wanted to, though.
Just do it.
But that's,
I mean, as an author, I am petrified when someone asks me to autograph their book, but I do it. Sometimes I try and think of something witty, and usually I fall completely flat on my face at that moment, because when you're trying to be witty,
Well,
anyone who listens to the show will find out.
Yes, exactly, exactly. though I will say, to warn you, I can probably produce your books in 2 minutes now. I think I know exactly where they are. There is a shelf space in another room.
Oh, that's
where
fair.
That's where the lower 48.
I will at least sign them. I can't guarantee that something will end up in there.
But maybe. We'll see how the night goes. but, you know, in this book, Vertigo of Late Modernity, he talks about how what he calls what is the vertigo of late modernity is we live in a time when individualism has probably never been more prized.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, we're being pulled in this direction. In the other, in this weird kind of dichotomy, the things by which people traditionally would have kind of hung their hat of identity on,
mm-hmm.
nation state, religion, profession, all of those things are being radically devalued yes. by like global capitalism, where, you know, hey, you know, maybe everywhere is just sort of like America now, and we're not so special. Or, you know, while you do a job, and, well, that job sucks, man. Mm-hmm. It sucks that you do that. You know, we live in the country where people change religions more than once. 61% of Americans, I believe it is, change religions more than once, according to the Pew Research Center. And so, yeah, we have hyper-individualism, but the actual things that you would do to say, I am this yes. person, you know, I live in anonymous suburban Shittsville, just 20 minutes outside of downtown, you know, right? Because that's what people do, right?
That's what people do, but one of the things about automation, which is what we're moving to,
yeah.
is that it completely eliminates you being able to identify with a position or a job. Everything becomes fleeting in that regard.
We're all contingent.
We're all slowly becoming phased out in one way, shape, or form, another. And this is where the death of capitalism comes in, or the mutation of capitalism into something else.
Yeah.
Which is the stage that we're going to. Yeah. Capitalism needed to exist with and in tandem to the Industrial Revolution, because you needed to work, you needed to get something for your work, then you needed to identify or possess something
yeah.
through that. America yeah. did that better than anybody else.
Yeah. It's
materialism. Now, materialism is dying, obviously. You know, work itself is dying.
Yeah.
And we haven't hit the next place yet, whether it be collectivism or whatever it is. So you have this fighting concept of individualism, or this fleeting concept of individualism. Just doesn't exist anymore. We're all just struggling within this small realm, and nobody's recognizing the struggle together.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to be an internalized thing rather than a thing that it's like, oh, well, if we all do
all
this
your fault. I mean,
oh yeah, well, I mean, that's part of
I guess
you know, the Children of Goldwater
yeah
that we were talking about last time.
Yeah, I mean, there was that article in the Baffler recently. It showed up on my live feed a couple times, and a couple people retweeted about this sort of like case for radical self-care now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like everything is, well, how do you do the life hack? If you haven't hacked your life, what the fuck are you doing, man? And it's this thing that like sort of drives people nuts. And to maybe actually get to this idea of, you know, for me, thinking about this vertigo of late modernity, or this lack of hope or whatever for humanity, is one of the really important tools of that the human beings have used over the centuries, decades, millenniums, whatever, of this sort of humanities, of art, of music, of all of these things to help, you know, celebrate various aspects of their own experience, to understand their own experience, whatever, to explore other experiences, seems to be weirdly devalued.
Yes, I would agree with that 100%.
It's weird. I guess I do say, I mean, a lot of the times, you know, every time I have somebody on to talk about their band or something on this podcast, somewhere in the back of my mind, I'm even thinking about what does it mean to make music in an era where recorded music has little to no value.
Well, you also have oversaturation to go with that. So
yeah.
Oversaturation with devaluation basically just means you're farting in the wind at a certain point in time.
Yeah.
I just did a a live radio show with a woman in Kansas earlier in the month, and we were talking about music, and I made my first record when I was 30. So there's that moment that you know you're just adding to the weight of material shit that's out there. This one more touchstone that maybe no one ever finds, and probably is no good ultimately in the eye of the universe anyway. But we have this need to create, so you just do it anyway. At least as an artist, you do it anyway.
And hope in 40 years, Numero puts it out.
Yeah. Somebody finds my record. I have a box or two of them at home. I claim it's my retirement fund. So at that moment, when somebody discovers, in air quotes, that record...
You could be doing the Bob Pollard thing. You're selling the copies of Propeller on eBay.
Yeah, I'll be that guy. It may never happen. Maybe those records just end up getting shot by one of my grandchildren with a shotgun. But that would be fitting, ultimately.
Oh, man.
But as a human, you have this, as a human who is creative, who has an artistic bent of some kind, you have this want to be remembered, but generally, generationally speaking, you won't be past two generations. I can't remember if you and I were talking about that.
That's a big theme for me, too, yeah.
Yes.
How long before everything we know and hold dear and see as common sense is just forgotten?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's one of those things. I mean, when I was in West Virginia over the weekend, I was following the first land battle of the Civil War along with that whole campaign of 1861, which effectively ended Confederate progress in West Virginia and made West Virginia into a northern state. And the reason I was doing that, other than the fact that I'm incredibly nerdy, is that I had either great uncles or great grandfathers who fought for the Union side, and I just wanted to see those places. I didn't have anything to follow on. I don't even have a muster roll to like stand there and go, I'm sure he was standing in this spot or whatnot.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to be there, and that ultimate moment where you realize 150 years of history has passed on since then. I know nothing of these people other than what I could find online without joining Ancestry.com.
Yeah.
So you find yourself chasing after ghosts, the things that would tie you into a structure of community, a history, a shared history. We don't have it. None of us have it. We can't. Maybe some of us do. I don't know how far your family line goes back, or whether you got stories further than, further back than 1940.
Not really. So my family, at least on my mother's side, got here in, about the 1880s?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there's a cemetery in Cleveland with some people in it. Johnstown flood actually happened, and they moved to Johnstown because the jobs rebuilding Johnstown.
That's a very practical thing to do.
Yeah, so you ditch Cleveland, go to Johnstown. I guess my grandfather, there were still some relatives in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a great story of him like hopping trains, freight trains, to go to Cleveland. And one time he poked his head out of the boxcar, and there was a shotgun pointed at his head, and he went to the judge, and the judge said, I'm letting you go, but if I ever see you in my courtroom again for hopping trains and throwing the book out of you. And so he walked out of Cleveland and hopped on a freight train and went home.
Fair enough. Grab another train.
Grab another train, yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, and so, but beyond that, I mean, hey, the house that my grandparents owned, that my mother grew up in, because it's Johnstown, man, was taken out by a serial arsonist.
In Johnstown, what else would there be? Floods and serial arsonists.
And heroin. Heroin's huge.
Yeah, that happens.
And speaking of maybe corrupted humanism or the pitifulness of the human condition, I still have to work on the poem about this. This happened a couple of years ago, but we were driving through the West End of Johnstown on my way to my uncle's house in Richland, and it was Christmas was on, I think, Monday. Yes, Christmas is on Monday. And so I think the beer store, it was Christmas Eve. It was some weird thing where, yeah, so Christmas wasn't, yes, no, Christmas was on Sunday.
Okay.
Christmas Eve was Saturday. And then probably Monday the beer store might have still been closed or something, but this guy was going to have an extra day without the beer store.
Oh, Jesus.
Yes. And so we're driving in front of the abandoned, it is now gone, bakery that Gobbs came out of, used to come out
okay.
of. And this man has an old lady trolley, one of those old lady two-wheel trolley shopping carts with the big wire basket. And he had two 30-packs of Milwaukee's Best. Not even Milwaukee's Best Ice. It was Milwaukee's Best.
At least it wasn't Old German.
It wasn't Old German, I guess. But he was struggling in the snow to try to get this cart. Because, of course, it's an abandoned building, the sidewalk, you know, that way that the snow just gets compressed into hard ice, you know, hard lumpy ice, you know, that's occasionally slushy in spots, you know.
And there's no four-wheel drive on old lady shopping
carts. Old lady shopping carts. And this guy, like, and I'm just imagining this guy trying to get back to his apartment so he can watch, you know, over-the-air TV on a TV that's probably sitting on a kitchen chair or something in his next to his cot, and just going to just get totally fucked for the next 48 hours on these 30 cans of beer and
60.
Have 60 cans of beer. You're right. 60 cans of beer on his beast, having his beast Christmas.
Basically 60 cans of water with a little bit of beer inside.
Yes.
Exactly. Enough beer to keep the DTs off.
Yes, exactly. And thinking like, wow, that's a human being. That is a fully sentient human being. And that is
existing in the barely category, wounded by society to a level that they can't go anywhere else. I have a poem for you
that oh, good.
Will fit all of this
to some extent.
This is called the Half Day Hymn. You know, I figured I should write, you know, read a poem at least once.
Yeah, please do.
Or maybe I'll read more. You know,
just please do. Save us. Save us all.
Save us all. This is called
Save Me From Myself.
The Half Day Hymn. I gotta read this off a computer screen, so I apologize. I had a powerful urge for fried chicken and collard greens. On a half-day vacation, I figured I'd mind it. Carmies on the north side will stop a heart every time. After the feast, I got time before work. A little drive, a little putt-putt, a little pissing around. I take the long way through Manchester, the part that died when they cut the expressway in. I take the Marshall Avenue exit, past the cemetery my father and his family occupy, past my mother's childhood home, or the lot since it burned down in the 80s. I pass a tow truck driver funeral spilling into the street, past the street my father lived on as a child, past the house my aunt lived, past the high school that, to tell a family secret, my father was expelled for inciting a race riot. Past the church I was baptized in, and to pass an odd fact, I've been baptized as many times as I've had a concussion. That number is 3. Lutheran, Catholic, Church of God, or 2 accidents and 1 work accident, one of which almost cost me an ear. And finally, I passed the street I lived on the longest. All of a sudden, I can't tally all of my haunted houses. Everything passes in a few short minutes. A small world, tiny histories, no one notices, except maybe this generation, the one before and the one after. A generation to build narratives, a generation to forget history. These tiny histories, this afternoon in full bloom of nostalgia. For a moment I think about that world, how it all used to seem so much smaller, and briefly I long for the world to be small. Again.
All right.
I think that's what we were talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, that is exactly what we are talking about. And
now I just depressed you and we don't want to talk.
Is this podcast just two grumpy grumpy old men talking about the passage of time.
Yeah, pretty much. This is what happens. I mean, your birthday is, what, next week, right?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
A week from today, actually.
Yeah, see? This shit happens. No less it's two cancers sitting in a room grumping about time.
Yeah.
Which is probably even worse in that regard.
You're not wrong.
I didn't think I was wrong.
But I think there is something to be said. You know, we live in a world now, too, where you have these, like, fucking idiots who can write code. They can write code. They're real brilliant at that. But in terms of, like, human interaction shit, and they're really bad, and they're the ones redesigning the world according to this vision or this idea of, you know.
Yeah, this is the last vestige of the Industrial Revolution, though. You know, finding jobs for people, and people found this one thing that they were good at. God knows what that would have been 500 years ago, you know, before 1650, when the first mill started in England or whatever it was.
Yeah, I don't know what those people, maybe they would just become monks. Would have just been, you know, celibate in some hole somewhere and just not talked and thought about things. And
but the utter explosion of people and the utter explosion of jobs to find for people and the utter explosion of niches, which is probably maybe one of the worst parts about
America. Yes, oh yeah, we can all perfect everything.
Again, there's no individualism. But then there's, like, individualism in pockets.
Because we're really into this thing. We have a fetish and interest.
Mm-hmm. There's not that policy of, like, Renaissance where you're trying to stretch across the board and find many, many things. It's just, like, this one minute detail that you can keep
Stargate SG-1 or something. Yeah,
exactly.
Which reminds me, there's a book on the shelf, actually, Terry Eagleton's After Theory,
mm-hmm.
where he uses as a metaphor, and it's an image that has haunted me ever since I read that book, of there was a medieval monk who was doing the dictionary. He was scribing out a dictionary. That's what you did. You just rewrote other books, and it would take somebody about a year to make another book, copy a book. And he was doing a dictionary, and he forgot the letter S. And it was on a scroll, so he was just fucked. And it's this question of, it's this incredible act of blindness, A. B, I questioned myself, at what point? Was it somewhere in T, Q, X?
Maybe there was
Where was he X? Maybe it was the Z? Where was it? Like, or did he finish? And they were like, hey, Marty, what about S? You know?
He wasted a year of his life.
He wasted a year of his life because to make this dictionary and forgot S.
Well, I guess...
And aren't we all forgetting S?
Somehow we are all forgetting S. And this is back in the time when the Pope had to approve all books. So Imperator, it may be printed. Nihil Obstat, was it the other one? It can't be permitted. I can't remember any. Yeah. Obscure history things.
Yeah, I'm thinking now is what did I do with my Roman index of banned books? When I that might be somewhere in I have the 1915 Student's Guide to the Roman Index of Banned Books somewhere.
Okay.
In my possession, but you can see, you know, what you're
supposed to. What wasn't allowed to be printed.
What wasn't allowed to be printed, or at the very least, what wasn't allowed to be read. Oh. There it is.
It's behind my picture of John Waters. It's the exact right place for it to be.
Yeah, actually, I have not read it, but there's a whole, like, the first part of the book is a justification of why you need banned books, why you need this book, banned books, and why these certain books are banned, and then at the end is just this appendix of everything that you're not supposed to read, or else it's, I guess, a mortal sin or something.
John Stuart Mill? George Sand? I mean, there's a who's who of things you just should not be reading in here. Alexander Dumas? I don't know why you couldn't read Alexander Dumas. I mean, is escaping from jail like escaping from the church?
Well, you know, man, God's Law, Man's Law. I mean, it's 1917, Roman Index of Forbidden Books. I had a college roommate who was very... legalistic in his practice of Catholicism. He was very Byzantine Catholic.
Okay.
But also very much was working the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did a college prank.
Okay.
That was something illegal. And
I won't ask, I suppose.
Yeah. I don't know. I was like suddenly having this moment because I'm no longer friends with this person, mm-hmm. and then that could be, but the internet's forever, and he could Google me and he could find this, and I'll listen to him. I missed the sound of his voice or something. And he's like, "You've told me." And he actually, I guess, oh, he also works for the state now.
Okay.
So, not going to say what the prank was, but it was something that was illegal.
Okay.
And he made a point of then seeing what the statute of limitations was on this prank so that he could confess the sin, because if you obey God's law, you're supposed to obey man's law. And so if you confess a crime in the confessional and then you don't confess it to the police,
right,
it doesn't count, it doesn't stick. You know, it's one of those,
you were absolved in one place the other
but not
matter.
The other, I mean, it's the equivalent of, you know, I don't know, stepping out of bounds before taking the shot, you know, or again, basketball metaphor, you know, the buzzer rang and then you took the shot, you know, one of those deals.
Oh, I mean, by the Catholic view, even the Byzantine Catholic view of the afterlife, you want to be clear afterwards. I mean, the body doesn't last that long.
Yeah, the body doesn't last.
So, I mean, you can completely dissolve before, you know, that crime becomes a thing. But if you've confessed it to God, I suppose, you're all good.
Yeah, well, so his thing was, so he wasn't going to confess it until then the other part, the man's law, just wouldn't matter. So he was like, no, I'm not confessing that for another, like, 3 years. I remember him saying this to me, because then...
Then he was clear.
Then it's clear, then it'll count. You know, it's the Marvel, yes, and it counts! You know, like, sort of thing.
Score! I can still go to heaven, but I can't go to jail.
Yeah, isn't that the best of all worlds? But so...
This sounds like the Republican National Convention, actually.
It does, man. Poor Cleveland.
Poor Cleveland.
Sure, the Indians are in first place, but man, I...
What? At what cost?
At what cost? The LeBron won. The hockey team won in their league.
Yeah.
But man, I was having this conversation today. I was like, wow, I really hope that people don't go to that convention and then, much like a Pittsburgh Kenny Chesney concert, you know, get amped up and then just find some poor random African-American gentleman and throw him on train tracks. Hopefully. You know what I mean? I hope that doesn't happen, but I sort of expect it to happen.
Well,
somebody will just get amped up from the convention and then just go punch the shit out of somebody for no reason.
I mean,
a random hate crime.
Yeah, the cycle of history that we're running on right now, that somehow would not be surprising. I guess to go forward, you have to go backwards a little bit. I
don't know.
I really, I keep hoping that that's not the case, but it seems.
It seems like we forget lessons.
Yes.
Of lots of things.
Well, I definitely, in that grumpy old man phase, feel like as a country we were more progressive when I was younger.
I feel the same way.
And the older we get, this is becoming more of a staunchly conservative neighborhood.
Yeah.
Nation. And
yeah,
it doesn't reflect my position. And mm-hmm. certainly I have not gotten more conservative. I've gotten more radical, more leftist over the course
I think it's too. It's, you know, we live as urbanites in this wonderful cosmopolitan bubble.
That's true.
And the rest of the world, the rest of our country
doesn't necessarily.
And you think, I mean, the same thing with the Brexit vote.
Right.
It was the people in the countryside, the people who aren't engaged in the world and immigrants.
Were the ones who are voting.
They're ones who are voting against it. You know, that great John Stewart line about the 2004 election.
Mm-hmm.
You know, George W. Bush won the country when he won voters in rural Ohio. And those voters were concerned with gays and Islamic terrorism. And Manhattan, that, you know, had the biggest instance of Islamic terrorism and has a very open and active gay community, voted 95% for John Kerry.
Right.
You know? is...
And it also just boggles my mind with the amount of information and the speed of information that it still isn't, you know, circulating as far out. I mean, you have the city, and you can always count on a city generally to be liberal.
Yeah.
Maybe not Dallas, but. Although Dallas is...
Yeah.
A little bit better than it used to be in that regard.
But, you know, hey, I mean, the internet doesn't go everywhere.
And people don't use the tools at their disposal to gain the information that they need, is the more important part. They are not engaged, and maybe part of the secret of America's success is allowing people to disengage.
Yeah.
And I mean, even for people who are engaged, it's questioning how far engaged you are and how much you want to take the bull by the horns.
Yeah.
You know, are you getting out there and are you protesting or are you just signing petitions?
On Facebook. You know,
yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that becomes the question of where you are as a human and what you're actually capable of. Most of us are working a little too much to go take the bull by the horns.
Yeah.
You know, we're tied into the system, which is the beauty of capitalism in the same respect.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that happens is, too, is, you know, and thinking about even the realities of a lot of my friends who still live up the mountain, you know, is... I think there's something to be said about, and I've said this a few times actually on this podcast, sorry regular listeners, but if you also have a world where maybe your funhouse mirror and your socialization is media, how inadequate that makes a person.
Yes.
You know, because you can never be as great as.
Right.
You know, I remember when I was a kid, you know, pre-insanity Dennis Miller.
Okay.
And I remember... You know, I didn't do a whole lot of homework in high school, but I read the paper every day.
Okay.
And I listened to a lot of music, and I was just starting to really kind of start to explore the aesthetic world and go, oh, there's this really cool shit, and there's knowledge I can have and all of that. And kind of starting to explore this stuff ferociously and then thinking, you know, I had these maniacal dreams of being a writer or being, you know, somebody who... would, you know, say words and people would listen to them somehow, you know, and of course we know those things never came true, but I remember watching one of his comedy specials and going and just laughing, and the way that he used to be really thoughtful and really progressive and really interesting and pre-crazy Dennis Miller, and I remember thinking, wow, I'll never do anything that good.
But that's why you make art, so you maybe get that chance. And simultaneously, who the fuck's to say that you aren't making something that good? I mean, I don't know what you're making right now, so...
Not good.
But it's for history to decide.
It's for society to decide.
It's not for you to decide, was the general point of that.
We're all hoping for Numero someday.
We're all hoping to be reissued by the Numero label.
Yeah, I'm still gonna make that noise cassette this summer, maybe. Maybe not this summer. Time's kind of running out for me.
Yeah, I come back to my dorm room and listen to my noise cassette.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That's an old joke at this point in time.
Yeah.
But, but
I think there's something to be said for me, at least, I find. As you say about we're being buried by history. I will say there's something that's really, for me, empowering about enjoying things on the small scale.
Oh, I can understand that.
I've never been to an arena concert.
I went to my first this year.
Really?
I did. First?
Mm-hmm. What drug you out?
Springsteen. I had to do it once. So I got to see how that worked. A small city of people... in an arena, spending more money than they actually had to see a man in his 60s sing songs about working class Americans that were sitting in front of him, but obviously he didn't make tickets affordable for those working class Americans. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Irony to be had. But
irony to be had. Actually, I do, speaking of things to create, Verso has that Counterblast series, and I actually have the book on Bono.
Oh, God.
And I was reading the book on Bono and how Bono is the champion of neoliberalism, and I was actually reading it for the purpose of thinking, like, man, I should just float a book proposal to these people about Springsteen, you know. And I found, you know, the when I guess it was Portland, a couple years ago in the 90s. There was the municipal workers were striking, and he was having a concert in municipal arena, and the roadies refused to cross the picket line, and so they fired all of them and flew in scabs, and you know, and there's this great newspaper line where one of the strikers was like, "Well, I guess it's all just an act," you know, and things like that. That's for me is dehumanizing. I don't know how it exists in that space. But yeah, you know what? $6 to see a band at Gooskies.
Yeah.
I'm there.
Yeah, I can understand that. But $70 for a ticket to see Springsteen, where he gives you the gospel preacher at the beginning. Are you ready to be transformed? I wasn't necessarily transformed. I was transported to some other place. I had some, memories, maybe a feeling or two along the way. But I was certainly not transformed. I surely was not transmogrified.
Yeah. No, no, no. But, you know, so I think maybe is it that this making, is this, you know, the dream, the D. Boone, Mike Watt dream of, you know, a band on every block? You know, and then maybe that's just where we're going. And is that kind of going to be okay?
No,
I mean, I don't know how that turns into maybe progressive collective political action.
I have no idea. I mean,
but
I think that's part of... If you want to go down that rabbit hole, that's part of the question that most people who are working in the music business are trying to figure out at this point in time. This mass market concept does not work anymore, and obviously, you have major labels that are about to death spiral. There is a crash coming in this regard. So where do we go back to? Do we end up going back to regional radio as it was in the 60s, which would be far more interesting, obviously.
Yeah, it would.
Than where we are, you know, with Doctor's Office Radio.
Yeah, Clear Channel Hell.
Yeah, Clear Channel Hell, you know, some company owning 7 stations and limiting and, you know, whittling of playlists down to the same, what is it, probably 75 songs now stretched across every station.
Yeah. Yeah, I, 105.9 The X, which is the local, you know, thing.
Mm-hmm.
Last year for my birthday, we had a 90s theme party. And I thought to myself, well, shit, I have a car from the 90s. It's the day of the party. I need to go out and buy things to make my, I found a recipe online for Zima.
Mm-hmm.
For engineering your own
God,
Zima.
I remember drinking Zima. Shit.
Zima and... In all
Jolly
ironies.
Ranchers inside? Oof.
No.
Oh, you didn't go Jolly Rancher?
Go Jolly Rancher, but I did make Ecto Cooler, which is now you can just go fucking buy it if you can find it.
Well, with the new Ghostbusters, I'm sure there's a tie-in Ecto Cooler.
There is. No, it's back.
Okay,
Ecto Cooler is back, and there's a whole thing on Twitter of people reporting, I found it and bought it all, or whatever. Because that happens, I guess.
All I remember about that is there was so much sugar in it, it made your teeth hurt.
Yeah, the reverse engineered Ecto Cooler, which was like 9 ingredients, all of which were sugary drinks that I then added sugar and green food dye to.
Oh, man.
And I will say, people at the party report that I got it perfect.
That's fair.
You know, I nailed it. But so I was driving around for that, and I put that station on, and of course, what was the first song I heard?
Was it the theme from Ghostbusters?
No, it was Under the Bridge by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, that would be an appropriate 90s song.
Yeah.
You don't need to go back to the 80s. I'm sorry, I got
confused. No, yeah, the 90s.
On our digression.
You know.
Anthony Kiedis running through the streets of L.A.
L.A., yeah. You know, it's Tonight by... Today by Smashing Pumpkins. Mm-hmm. All of this thing. And they were playing a new song, though. They were playing Lampshades on Fire by Modest Mouse. And in the process of me driving from one part of town over to another part of town to a third part of town, you know, for people, well, should I say, for people not from Pittsburgh, what, here to Lawrenceville is...
5 miles, I think.
5 miles.
I'm going to say 5. I don't think it is, but it's...
Yeah. To the homestead is another 5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And then back here?
Yeah, so you did like 15 miles.
15 miles over the course of a day with grocery stores, beer distros, and stuff in between.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that song 3 times.
That doesn't surprise me.
I heard that song 3 fucking times. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, wow, if I still listen to radio, and I don't listen to radio,
yes,
other than being nostalgia, or the CD player in my 90s car decides it doesn't want to eject CDs anymore, then I just listen to classical station. I was like, wow, I would hate this band. Mm-hmm. I like this band. I would hate this band.
Oh,
if it was shoved down my throat that badly. But the rest of it was pretty much the same songs that when I turned that station off in the year 2000, 2001, it was the same
songs. No, the playlist has not adapted by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, and people's view of music because of that seems to get smaller for some ungodly reason. I mean, working in a record store and talking to other record store employees, managers, etc., it's the same 20 to 50 artists that people are looking for. And it's specifically that. They don't want to know that there's somebody that sounds like this, you know, or similar, or did this better, even.
Or did this better, or was the influence, or they were in another band, or whatever.
And it's the same 50 across the board, you know. So it's like, no, I don't have that record. That record's not in print. Yes, I still have Bowie records. Go buy all the Bowie records you want. Have fun with that. I love Bowie. You should enjoy that. But
yeah, I mean, remember Jerry. Actually, Jerry's one time I did hear that from him, the spiel, because a guy came in there, went up to the counter, asked, "You got Doors LA Woman?"
Mm-hmm.
He's like, "Yeah, back in the stacks there." He goes, buys that one record and leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And said, yeah, there's 50 rock records everybody wants, 50 jazz records, 50 classical, 50 country, and that's it. Once you have those 500 records, you don't need to buy another record.
Yeah. Do you have Metallica, Billy Joel, The Doors, blah, blah, blah? There's more music, please.
There is a lot more music. There's a lot more exciting music, but
what can you do? You're sold a certain thing. You're sold, much like associating logos throughout the course of your life. Your radio station plays you these 10 artists, and even your Pandora station doesn't play you much more than that at this point.
Yeah.
How do you discover? How do you dig deeper than that? The internet is there for you. The internet is a whole other hydra of rabbit holes and...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I get that. It's weird because I have friends, smart people that I love being around, and whenever, you know, I'm either their dealer, you know what I mean? Like, they come over and like, what are you listening to? And I'll be like, oh, try this, try that. You know, I will always have, you know, something I bought probably that I bought this week, because maybe I have a problem, maybe I don't, I'm fine. There's no dead cats under the music collection. It's organized. It's not hoarding.
Are you sure there are no dead cats?
Hey, there's only one cat in this house, and she's in the bathroom.
I have run into her. She was alive. You're right.
Yes.
Okay. How do you know she hasn't, like, killed another cat?
There's not another cat in here, man. It's not allowed another cat. We will own one cat in our lives. Her name is Talbot. She's very sweet, but has some emotional problems.
I've been told the same thing about myself.
But, they all look at me like whenever I hear something or I've heard something or I'm really into something, you know, they're like, how did you find out about this? Like, I mean, it's almost like it is this mystical, like, you've traveled through time? You know what I mean? You own a time machine? You have mastered the wormhole? How did you do that?
But this is part
of
the problem.
Could you take me with you? You know, I mean, it's this weird thing, and it's like, no, you're a smart, creative, funny person. You should take the reins and go and explore and be... And it's like, no.
But see, this is part of the problem with too much information. And I never want to say that there's too much information, but people just don't know how to navigate. I get deer in headlights moments. You know, when it's like, oh, I want to read about this, and then I like Google search it, and I'm like, oh shit, there's like 60 articles. I might be able to read 5 before I get bored. You know, so where do you look, and how do you filter? I suppose when there's so many things being barraged at you at any given moment.
There's this great book called Tyranny of the Moment called Thomas Highland Erickson, and he has that great line. It's like, the challenge of the information age now is blotting out the 99.8% of information you don't want and don't need.
Yeah.
You know, that's available. Yeah, it's a hard thing. So is there a new... I sometimes think when I get down about world events or the 2016 election especially, or just... The unique brand of crazy that I just see walking around in the world. The unique brand of socially acceptable crazy that defines people in the year 2016, I think, is that maybe are we just going through this really awkward, massive transitional phase?
Well, I think...
And whatever comes next will be something else.
Mm-hmm. I think you've nailed that right there. I mean, that's exactly where we are. I mean, you're at the... Again, the end of the Industrial Revolution. You're at the end of capitalism, in theory. You're at, you know, the end of a very white history, a very white world. You have a much more racially integrated world coming to you very shortly. And obviously we're having many hiccups about that concept at this point in time.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of interesting acceptance going through in all of this, but things are not moving fast enough.
Yeah.
And do we need a generation to die for it to move ahead? What is exactly, what's going to propel this through? And will, hopefully, it go peaceably and not violently, which is, I think, what most of us are hoping.
Yeah.
We can do this as peaceably as possible.
Yeah. And I guess is if there is hope for humanity, it's thinking that someday we'll be like, man, people in 2016 were really fucking stupid. Right? I mean,
yeah.
that's where we're... Isn't that what we want?
Yeah. I hope that we can think about that. Yeah. I would like to think that this whole thing would be pretty stupid. I mean, Donald Trump and Boris Johnson are just enough to tell you how stupid things might just be at this point in time.
Yeah.
Please read Upton Sinclair's It Can't Happen Here Now. Before the election cycle finally finishes up, just read it. It might be a little heavy-handed, but,
you know,
the rise of fascism in America is a real thing. The rise of fascism in Britain is a real thing. We've gone through this cycle in history already. Yeah. It was called the 30s.
Yeah.
And we had to fight a really messy war for it. Several messy wars.
But maybe, you know, if there's hope, too. Remember what New York Times last week, or 2 weeks ago now, you know, the Italians are looking at, you know, what's happening in Britain, what happened in Austria, where the super-duper far-right...
Mm-hmm.
Party failed by a few thousand votes from coming into power.
Even
looking
Germany.
At Trump, you know, saying, you know, they had Berlusconi. They did it.
Yeah.
They're cool. Like, at this point, they're like, yeah, we tried that. It happened. We learned. We're cool. We can look at the rest of you now and go, man, that's not going to be fun to live through.
No.
Because we lived through it. It's almost like, you know, the drunk... You know, friend helping the more drunk friend, you know, trying to talk him down. Like, dude, you just got to make yourself puke, man. If you just let it, don't try to hold it in, man. You're just making yourself more sick. Just let it go. Just put your chin up to the bowl and just let it go, man. And you'll start feeling better immediately. I know. I hate the puke too, man. I know. Listen. Just let it happen.
Just let it happen, though. Let it out.
let it out.
And that maybe also becomes the other question. Do you need Donald Trump?
God, I hope not.
You know, to make shit so bad that people finally realize, you know, what a democracy was and how democracy is actually a pretty good system of government if capitalism isn't there to fuck it up subvert it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatnot. Maybe people need that reminder, that wake-up call. I really hope we don't need to go there to do this.
No,
I mean, I don't want to have to go through this shit.
No.
I mean, again, this is the grumpy old man in me, I'm sure.
It's the grumpy old man, and I say, hey, we're two grumpy old heterosexual white men.
Yeah.
And our freedoms won't necessarily, you know, be threatened as much as other people. I mean, it's like, it's a moment in history I think about a lot of friends that I have... For whom, wow, you know, life could really get significantly worse.
Yeah, I mean, there is a modicum of privilege there that no matter what, you can't deny. So, yeah, you have some ultimate protection, but not really. And
yeah.
Then your job as an educated white male would be to try and, you know, fuck the system back from hurting or disturbing or impinging on other people's freedoms.
Yeah.
You know, I was having a conversation with my brother about this probably in February, me and him and his wife, about the possibility of a Trump presidency and, you know, people talking about how they needed to leave America if that happened. And I said, you know, I'm not leaving at that point in time. This is the moment you get the wire cutters and you go and you chop the fences with the wire cutters and you get people out. And, you know, you actively find a way to make civil disobedience happen. And if it needs to be more than civil disobedience, so fucking be it. You know, we're already in a dangerous position, and we do not recognize, we recognize a very limited amount of human rights, which should be expanded greatly. That situation is not going to get any better under a Trump-Pence presidency. As a matter of fact, it will get significantly worse. It may get better with a Hillary presidency. The hope, certainly there. You know, as a two-party system, you can't do anything but vote for the two horses that are in the race. Is that Bernie can expand the Democratic platform, or that, you know, Hillary has enough of a lead that some people can start to vote for Jill Stein and maybe finally, as idealistically I did in 2000, tried to get the Green Party funding. You know?
Yeah.
So you voted so that they got their, what was it, 10% or 8% or whatever it needs to be that that party platform can be funded by the government. I think I've completely lost my train of thought where
that's
I was going.
Okay, actually, we're doing great on time. Actually, would you like to read one more poem before the bottom five?
All right, well, why don't I...
poem, and then the bottom five, and hey, if you want to answer any of the bottom five with poems, that would work too.
That might work. So this is, I started to tell you this story, and somewhat appropriate to where we are. This is a poem called The Great American Apple Pie Fight. I found Snow White, Seven Dwarfs, Spider-Man, Laurel and Hardy, and the Blues Brothers, dancing, holding still, outside of the Petersburg Chamber of Commerce. All the while, Lee Greenwood sang the chorus of Proud to Be an American, an endless loop. I was moved. I was moved. It was like I had an apple pie fight with God.
That is fantastic. That is fantastic. And
that's why I didn't finish the story. There was a punchline.
That's a great punchline, man. Wow. It's now time for the bottom five. A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I don't know if I have to have poems or what I have to be ready for.
Well, let's see. I'm ready. Well, the first one, it's not really a question, it's a prompt.
Okay.
Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood.
Oh, God.
He's shuffling papers.
I'm shuffling papers.
There is a poem.
There might be a poem. See, all these are so consequential. Maybe. I don't know. Shuffling of papers. I don't know what to do here. I feel like a deer in a headlight.
That's all right, man. This is pretty fantastic, though, man. You are ripping through here.
I know.
This is pretty good. You just scanned about, what, 20 different
poems? Yeah, like...
a matter of seconds. That was intense. Too bad this is not a video podcast.
You just watched my brain go into, like, overload mode. So I'm just going to read you the first poem from the Studs Terkel Blues, which is a poem called The Auto Body Shop. It's about the first job I ever had. It was supposed to be my brother's job. After school days to sweep up in an auto body shop, my brother was 13. Too young, but more outgoing, he was the better choice. I accepted $5.50 an hour under the table, paid in cash, an hour or two a night. The guy who did body work, Kenny, he smoked crack, but not at work. He had quit a couple of times, been fired the same amount, had stolen money and tools. Still, the boss would invite him back. He'd work till he slid back to drugs. My boss, Bill, a former alcoholic, now born-again Christian. He was happy to tell stories of the people he fucked over, the cars he stole, the benders he tore through. He was, at one point, the terror of the North Side. Now he was a man of God who laughed too loud and said things like, "If sheep could cook, we wouldn't need women." And I tried to have sex with my wife last night, but she was on her period. Game called due to muddy field. I held that job for 4 seasons. Sweeping up in autumn, dust thick in the air became washing cars in winter, pressure washer beads freezing in blizzard afternoons, tape and paper springtime. Clean lines for paint spray particles, spray primer summers, heat and throat burnt by chemicals in closed spaces. Like so many jobs, it fell away. One day it was, one day it wasn't. Jobs like people fall out of our pockets. Sometimes maybe more when you're 17. As inconsequential as I could get quickly.
Oh, awesome. That's fantastic. All right. Question two. If you could unmake any invention, what would it be? There's some way you could just go back, kill baby inventor of something.
Can it be a system? Because, I mean, we've been railing against capitalism.
Yeah, at least we've been railing against capitalism, so maybe...
Maybe we just need to go back and erase the Wealth of Nations. We'll take out the S chapter in the Wealth of Nations to bring this back around.
There you go, and then you take that out, and it reads sort of like Marx in places.
So yes.
It'll be all right.
Yeah.
It's all good. All right. Question three. Okay. This one's a little out there, man. It's a little sci-fi.
Okay.
Dig in, man. You ready? Okay, if we were living in a dystopian future, and the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin, would you, say, sacrifice yourself so that a book could survive into human memory or into the future? And what book would you donate your skin for? Asterisk, you can't say the Bible, Quran, or the complete works of Shakespeare. Those are easy choices. Somebody's already on that. But it is, you know, basically you would march yourself into the tannery with that book under your arm, and they would, you know, I don't know, smash your head between two cinder blocks and make a nice book jacket.
What about Knut Hamsun's Hunger?
I'm not familiar with that book.
John Fante would not have existed without Knut Hamsun. Knut Hamsun was a, I believe, Finnish writer, or Norwegian. In the 1890s, he wrote several books, of which I think Hunger was the first one, and the entire aesthetic of the book is that he is poor and he is finding ways to make himself more poor to suffer for his art. When you read it, if you then read Ask the Dust, which would come 35 years later, another amazing book, you see very much a similar both sense of humor about being poor, about being Catholic, about being, you know, this particular aesthetic that was being gone through, you know, and the difference between Finland or Norway. It must have been Norway. I think it was Oslo. And L.A., you know, completely a whole other side of the world.
Yes.
Let's go with that, just, you know, because it would be a book that maybe not other people would think about. So
there you go. Perfect. Wonderful. Great choice. Question four. We're almost out of this, man. If there is a hell and you end up there, Name one celebrity that you expect slash hope to meet there.
I don't have a poem about this either.
Oh!
Or do I? Do I write poems about people like that? Hello, cat. I don't have enough recall to do that quickly, so I'll leave it. And just, who would I find in hell?
That you hope and expect.
So it's almost so many people that you just hope and expect. I guess Reagan would have qualified for that.
Yes.
He's already dead, and certainly, hopefully, rotting in hell. Let's go with Alan Dulles, former head of the CIA, who's also dead now, but I expect him to be in hell. If I'm there, I would like to meet him, and, probably take a couple of swings at him, since he's part of the reason why we're in this fucked up situation that we're in currently, so...
There you go.
What's question five, though?
Question five! That's the thing. This one might be a poem. What mundane daily activity gives you the most joy?
What mundane daily activity? Well, I would suppose traveling would do that, so let me read you a poem about being bored on the road, if I can find it quickly.
It's all right. We're waiting. That is from your collection, The Lower 48.
From The Lower 48.
Which would be... We'll have a link as far as where you can get Lower 48, Studs Terkel Blues, and The Lady Pittsburgh, and all of your other fine stuff, right?
That's most of them, pretty much, at that point in time. Yeah, there it is. Page 50.
Page 50 of The Lower 48.
All right. This is a poem about the great state of Florida. It is called These Days of Heaven. It's in three parts. In the land of flowers, on the heels of conquistadors, not looking for the fountain of youth, looking for America. Out among the churches and forts older than the day I forgot my name, there are squirrels wrestling in royal palm. Occasional lizards fire across the trail, heat lightning on the ground, armadillos on a radar range, alligators gawked at by tourists that can only say here in English as they flash photos, amazed in German, French, and Japanese. And I will never doubt mosquitoes again. I carried their blood, which may be my blood with me. Communion stories and a million welts rising across the Everglades, through the Shark Valley, into the Big Cypress, where at panther crossings I wait for reeds to move. Where are the big cats of our imagination? Where is the sky? I want to keep it in my pocket. In Bradenton, it's a typical night. Redneck princesses in high heels and Daisy Dukes serve Cuban sandwiches in deli dives. Everyone drinks High Life on picnic benches outside, across the street a ball game. Prayers accompany the first pitch, the Star-Spangled Banner, the home team loss, followed by fireworks. Sitting on the hood of my car, flashback in gunpowder burst. Vastovagal visions of the Lady Florida in a dress of palm frond and hibiscus. She says, "You found America. Now can you find your soul?" 2. Stephen Foster rings carillon bells off-key, and I stand before mansions counting fire ants, remembering slaughter in live oaks and the dead at a lusty. 3. It's one of those days when nothing materializes. You just move, and you move, and you move, and the windshield is forever, and the love bugs are hitting just like rain, drop, drop, drop. And if you stop in cemeteries, you can watch turtles asleep on stones, look at the roadside, see the turkey vultures too lazy, barely turn up an occasional grub or an ant.
these days. These days are so sleepy and the windshield is forever and you're always 20 miles from Tampa or 20 miles from Williston or 20 miles from Hernando or 20 miles from Archer or 20 miles from Gainesville or 20 miles from the terminus of this forever fucking road. There is nothing. Maybe a dusty bookshop, a diner, a Burger King where everyone is too bored to mention they exist. These days, heat rises slow, the highway vanishes under haze. Stare off forever through a windshield. These days of heaven, these days are heaven. The windshield is forever.
Fantastic, man. Wow.
Boredom.
Boredom. The windshield is forever. The
windshield
yeah.
is forever. I love it.
But I really want to go for a road trip now.
I know. That was the whole point of Kerouac that it just gets missed for me. I don't know if we talked about this last time. There's always something happening. But there's so much not happening in between the places where something has to happen. I mean, I guess great if you can get that distillation to just bang moments. Yeah. Sorry if I spiked your thing there.
That's all right.
But
it didn't go red.
Yeah, it didn't go red. Cool. But, you know, if you're on the road, you find that there are days and there are hours. There are whole chunks of time where nothing actually happens. You can't find a conversation. Every waitress hates you. Nobody wants to talk to you. You're just another weird casualty of American society floating through American society and no one sees you.
Yeah.
That's my thing.
Yeah, no. I want it, man.
I want it too.
5 hours in a car is too much. And on that happy note, I guess that's about it.
Is that it?
That's it. Right. Again, I'll have links. I'll have to find them or remember them, or you'll tell me them when I hit pause here.
Yeah.
So you can find and buy these 5 fine books. I guess you could also at some point go to Soundcat Records and
ask me for them.
Ask you for them, or just try to have your own mini podcast conversation, because you'll be there. Thursdays are a really good day, I've heard. If you want some quality Jason Baldinger time. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gunna.podcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter @gunnadiepodcast. Sorry, @gunnadiepodcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to Brett, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.
Thanks, Matt.
You're welcome.